most stories that you write don't work out, and it's impossible to see where they go wrong. It's a mysterious kind of a craft. In some ways, it seems like the longer you're doing them, the more mysterious it becomes. You're not sure why some work out and some don't. I do think it's important in some ways to finish every story you try, even if it never gets outside the house. You kind of learn a lot from your failures. You learn a lot from the ones that don't work out. And I think by completing all the bad ones, all the ones that don't work out, you kind of earn some luck as a writer.
On today's episode of Shelf Life, I chat with Kevin Barry, the brilliant Irish author of the Booker-longlisted Nightboat to Tangier, about the influence on his writing of two great books. One is Saul Bellow's canonical novel Herzog, and the other is Annie Dillard's Pulitzer-winning Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Find out what Kevin Barry owes these two writers after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The deadline is fast approaching to avoid a partial government shutdown. The fiscal year ends Tuesday night, and Congress has not approved the regular bills to pay for government programs. President Trump is to meet tomorrow with congressional leaders on a stopgap bill, including Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer and Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. House Speaker Mike Johnson told CNN the president doesn't want the government to shut down.
I'm telling you where his head is. He wants to bring in the leaders to come in and act like leaders and do the right thing for the American people. It's fine to have partisan debates and squabbles, but you don't hold the people hostage for their services to allow yourself political cover. And that's what Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are doing right now.
The Democrats want a provision to extend health care subsidies for middle and low-income families that are now slated to expire this year. Officials in Oregon are pushing back against President Trump's announcement that he'll send federal troops into Portland. NPR's Matt Bloom has more.
Trump said in a post on social media that he will send troops to protect, quote, war-ravaged Portland and any of its ICE facilities as he threatens to expand his deployments to more American cities. State and local officials in Oregon say there have been small protests and some arrests recently outside of Portland's main ICE facility, but nothing they say is big enough to warrant a federal response. Mayor Keith Wilson spoke alongside the state's governor at a press conference.
President Trump has directed all necessary troops to Portland, Oregon. The number of necessary troops is zero.
Oregon's governor says the state will respond legally if Trump still sends troops, as he did to Los Angeles earlier this year. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meets with President Trump at the White House tomorrow as international pressure mounts to end the war against Hamas in Gaza. Netanyahu told the UN General Assembly last week Israel must finish the job against Hamas. NATO is sending military reinforcements to the Baltic Sea in light of several days of drone intrusions over the Nordic countries, especially Denmark. Terry Schultz reports.
A NATO military official says the alliance has been in constant contact with the Danish government about the daily appearances of drones in its airspace, including over military locations. Colonel Martin O'Donnell says NATO has therefore decided to step up its vigilance in the region by sending more resources to the Baltic Sentry operation set up in January, primarily to counter the cutting of undersea cables by ships linked to Moscow. O'Donnell says the additional assets include multiple intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms, and at least one air defense frigate. On Tuesday, Russia denied it was responsible for the drones. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Copenhagen.
This is NPR News. Thousands of people have been forced from their homes in central and northern Vietnam as a powerful typhoon approaches. It's expected to bring strong winds, heavy rain, and storm surges, which may trigger flash floods and landslides. Some airports are closed. The typhoon killed at least 10 people in the Philippines in recent days. Michelob Ultra is now America's top-selling beer. NPR's Ava Pukash reports it marks a return to the top spot for parent company Anheuser-Busch.
Michelob Ultra knocks Constellation's Modelo Especial out of the top spot, according to data by market researcher company Circana. Modelo had moved up in 2023 following backlash for a transgender influencer brand deal with then-top spot holder Bud Light of Anheuser-Busch. But Modelo's success is cooling. Constellation CEO Bill Newland said previously, Hispanic consumers make up about 50% of their overall business, and he said President Trump's immigration policy is affecting their spending habits. Anheuser-Busch says momentum for Michelob Ultra has grown with brand partnerships with the Olympic Games, NBA, and FIFA, as well as popularity for its non-alcoholic version. Eva Pukach, NPR News.
From beer to bears, Fat Bear Week is almost over. The annual competition features the brown bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska to celebrate their success in getting fat before the winter hibernation. Voting is open at explore.org until Tuesday night. Only one bear will be crowned the champion. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
Most stories that you write don't work out, and it's impossible to see where they go wrong. It's a mysterious kind of a craft. In some ways, it seems like the longer you're doing them, the more mysterious it becomes. You're not sure why some work out and some don't. I do think it's important in some ways to finish every story you try, even if it never gets outside the house. You kind of learn a lot from your failures. You learn a lot from the ones that don't work out. And I think by completing all the bad ones, all the ones that don't work out, you kind of earn some luck as a writer.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Love in all its forms is up for inspection in this episode of Shelf Life. It takes center stage in the short stories of my guest, the celebrated Irish writer Kevin Barry, best known for his 2019 novel Night Boat to Tangier, long-listed for the Booker Prize. Barry's third collection of short stories, That Old Country Music, just published in paperback, is a masterclass in how to write about men undone or remade by love. I think every novel I've written and every story I've written is essentially about people who can't escape their own past, he has said. They can never get past the blood, and they can never get past their background, and they're constantly striving to break out of that shadow. Unable to escape the past is one way of describing Herzog, one of the great characters in American fiction, a human tsunami of conflict and outrage, trying to find his footing after a failed marriage. Herzog elevated its author Saul Bellow into the pantheon of great American writers and onto the bookshelves of a young Kevin Barry. The other book we'll get to talk about today is Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard's love song of sorts to the fecundity and cruelty and majesty of nature, based on journals she kept about her excursions into the Virginia Valley, where she lived at the time. Kevin Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for having me. I'm in the city of Malaga in southern Spain at the moment, so an advance warning that there may be church bells.
We shall incorporate them as an acoustic backdrop.
You've got to get the church bells in, man. You've got to get the church bells.
Well, I have to say, Kevin, I devoured the stories in That Old Country Music. They're full of misfits and fragile, vulnerable men. I really loved the way that so many of them found a kind of harmony in the Irish countryside, a little like the narrator of your story, Old Stock. He visits his dying uncle, Aldo, in Donegal, and finds himself really overwhelmed by the beauty of the land. But you manage to summon it without being at all cliched about it. In fact, in that story, there's this very self-referential line where the narrator says that the beauty of the place could wreak havoc on a man's prose if you let it.
I mean, I undoubtedly have a lyric impulse in my work in terms of describing the landscape and the atmosphere of the landscape and what's going on in it. But very often I try to barb it as well to try and get away from the sentimentality of that traditional landscape description. There was a great Irish philosopher, I guess you'd call him, a guy called John Moriarty, who died about 10 years ago. And in talking about the landscape of the west of Ireland, he said that human feeling doesn't just exist in humans and people. It's settled into our places. It leaves resonances behind in our fields, on our mountains, on our street corners. And I think very often what writers are doing when they create a piece of work is they're responding to some feeling that a place has given off, a resonance that it's left on the air, an aura, to be all hippie-ish about it. Very often with me, a story, a short story, will start with a place that I've passed through or that I remember, and that I just kind of want to create something in homage to it almost.
Kevin, I know you were a cub reporter in Limerick. I wonder what those skills have lent themselves to your fiction. I'm thinking obviously about a reporter's ability to observe, to sort of try and understand what makes a person tick.
Yeah, I worked on small city newspapers as an old-fashioned cub reporter. Sounds like something out of a Damon Runyon story now, you know, but I did courts and city council meetings and all of that, and then freelanced all through my 20s and into my early 30s. On a pragmatic level, I think the great thing that a background in journalism gives to a writer is it takes a lot of the preciousness out of it. You know that you can always write. To some extent or to some degree, no matter what kind of a mood you're in or condition you're in, you can always get some words down on the page. So that's a very useful thing. It's been useful in other ways in my fiction writing career. I think in terms of a novel, very often the best research you can do for a novel, you don't realize it's research at the time. And when I came to write my first novel, City of Bohan, or at least the first novel I wrote that was published, I realized even though it was set in the 2050s, a future kind of vaguely deranged Irish town in a kind of a derelict neo-medieval future, I realized I was using so much stuff from my journalism days in Limerick and in Cork, actual deranged little Irish cities, stuff I'd picked up at court meetings and at council meetings, just about how these small cities organize themselves and how they work and how they tick. And it also gave me a language register in terms of using the language of Irish working classes in these small cities, my own background essentially as well, which had never shown up very much in Irish literature. I realized this great belligerent take on the English language had riches in it that I could work with.
One of the things that impressed me, though maybe it shouldn't, was that so many of these short stories, or several of them, appeared in the Irish Times. And I can't think of another national newspaper that publishes fiction like that.
Yeah, no, Ireland has that. Without singing our own praises too much, it remains a country that's very involved with books and with writing. We've certainly kind of, over the decades and centuries, I guess, punched above our weight in terms of the amount of writers produced, which is quite simply a factor of the weather, you know. About 9 or 10 months of the year, it's a grey, wet, dreary, miserable little rock, and you need to make stuff up. So that's why there are so many Irish writers. But no, it's a sacred ground for writers in lots of ways. Lots of problems with that as well, of course, when you're trying to find your own voice as a writer. So let's say when I was in my 20s, in my late 20s, trying to write stories in a serious way for the first time. And at that time, I think still in Irish literature, there was these two huge towering influences, Joyce and Beckett, hanging over contrary influences. Joyce, who put everything onto the page, and Beckett, who took everything back off the page and stripped it right down. And Irish writers are caught between those two kind of approaches often and kind of confused. But there are lots of other streams going back to Irish literature as well. And I was always very drawn to the kind of more mischievous, more roguish kind of writers like Flann O'Brien, writers who were kind of having a good time with it and winding the whole thing up.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today, the author, Kevin Barry. So, Kevin, I think you have an excerpt from one of the stories in that old country music that you can read for us now.
Yeah, we're in a pub in the southwest, in the far southwest of Ireland in County Cork, and the barkeeper there has been surprised in his winter solitude by a pair who've just arrived, quite an elderly lady and what appears to be her son.
They entered my pub like a squall of hectic weather. There was a kind of cheerful eeriness about them. They took, grinning, to the bar stools. He swiveled a half turn and squinted as he read the spirit labels. "It's an attractive selection, mother," he said. "Let's not be rash," Tony, she said. But she swiveled a half-turn too, and hers drew a slow creak to the room that sounded in a crescent moon shape ominously. We'll work our way across to Toppermost States, he said. Oh, Tony, she said, riding the Empire Builder again. He half rose from his stool, crooned a verse from the Black Hills of Dakota, fell back again. He was fey and thin and whippety. She had the remnants of a sharp-boned beauty yet. He's a dreadful child, but kind, she confided, and she laid her touch to the back of my hand where it gripped with white knuckles the bar top. Hers was paper brown and cut deep with wrinkles. A Laphroaig to set off from the station, he said, sitting again. Let's strap ourselves in, dear. Laphroaig, Tony, is that the peaty number? Like drinking the bloody fireplace, he said. Two, I said. Water to the side, he said. I set them and they sipped, and they considered each other with the same liquid eyes and relaxed. Have you travelled far today? Oh, Christ, he said. Was it Kenmare, mother? Was the last place. Horrendous, she said, and placed thin fingers to her throat in long-suffering. Full of horrible skinny Italians on bicycles, he said. Calves on like knitting needles and their root bits in lycra. I mean, it's bloody December. In fact, she said, we were rather run out of town. There was an incident, he confirmed over supper. Last night, she said, we're barely in the door and there's talk of the guards. Five-star melodrama, he said. Matinee and evening performances. We had stopped off, she said, en route. We were a little tired, he said. We thought we'd take things more gently today, she said. Nonsense, he said. We're riding the Empire Builder. We're taking the high ground. Is that a cork gin I see? It was second along the line of optics from the Laphroaig. I thought, surely they can't be in earnest. There was a line of nine spirits turned and hung along there. Mine's with just the tiniest drizzle of soda water, she said. Mine's a slice of lime if you have it, he said. To be honest, surprise me, he said. Straight up is fine, though I may become poisonous and embittered. Giving you a head start, she said. Do you see now, he said, do you see now what I'm dealing with? I tried for what I imagined was a half-smile and set their gins. One yourself, he said. I don't, actually. Sobriety was the mean violet of dusk through the bar's window, the mean view down the falling fields to the never-ending sea, the violet of another mean winter for me. Toronto, she cried. Oh, mother, he said, it's barely gone five. Anthony was conceived in Toronto, she said. I was Ophelia to Daddy's prince. We're talking 1953, barman. He didn't look 60. He had the faded, yellowish skin tone of a preserved lemon. Pickled, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. But it seems unkind.
I love the squall of hectic weather that you conjure as they come into the bar.
I'm not shy with weather. In my stories, a reader approached me once and said, in every single thing you've written, we're informed of what's going on with the weather inside two paragraphs or so. And I said, it's because I'm interested. I want to know as a reader myself, what's the weather doing outside? Because I guess so many of the stories and the novels that I write are set in the west of Ireland, where the weather is constantly shifting and rearranging itself. It has an effect on the psyche of the characters that I describe and that I write about.
You've written three novels and three short story collections. I can't help wondering if any of your novels started as short stories, or if you know from the outset what it's going to be.
I'm blessed or cursed with quite a fluent imagination, so there are always ideas and things I want to work at. But there is often a state of befuddlement or puzzlement early on when I'm trying to work out what exactly this creature I have is in front of me that I've dragged up onto the desk. But more often than not, if I have an idea, my first impulse is to see if I can make it work in the form of a short story. I guess I have a kind of congenital impatience as a writer. And the glorious thing about a story is, you know, you can be lucky and it can be one of those beautiful ones that works out for you in a week or two. And that's very attractive compared to the the long slog of a novel or of a play script or of a screenplay or whatever it is.
Do I detect that you feel more at ease, happier with the short story as a form?
I don't think that's the case. I come at them very differently, I guess. With the novel, I'm always interested in the novel as a place for experiment, to try and keep the novel, to try and see what I can do with it. I like the heat that's given off when you rub different genres up together. So my most recent novel, Nightboat to Tangier, had elements of noir and elements of thriller, elements of a crime novel, but written at full tilt, written in the high style, written in a very literary language. With a story, I'm very often as directly interested in sheer narrative about what happens next, what's going on.
In The Nightboat to Tangier, the port is an actual port that you passed through in the early 90s on your way to Tangier to pay homage to the legacy of William Burroughs.
Yeah. I was, what, 21 or 22? Yeah, I was at that stage where, you know, listening to the Velvet Underground and reading William Burroughs, and that was the kind of, that was the milieu. And with some friends, we went to Tangier and stayed in the hotel where he wrote The Naked Lunch and all of that. But when I thought back on the trip in the years succeeding, I remembered very little about Tangier, but I remembered a lot about Algeciras, the port in Spain where you get the ferry from. It's one of the great seedy places of the earth. They've cleaned up the ferry terminal a bit there, rather disappointingly. But I remember in the early 90s, it was one of the two transportation hubs that I've been most scared at in my time. I think the other one was the downtown LA Greyhound station in about 1996. That was pretty hairy. But the ferry terminal in Algeciras was memorably, cinematically seedy. And it lent itself as a stage for my characters, I guess.
In one of the short stories in your new collection, Extremadura or Until Night Falls, you have an Irishman, a kind of homeless Irishman in a decrepit Spanish town. It's easy to wonder what experience that story is drawn from.
Yeah, I wrote it in this very apartment, weirdly enough, about 5 years ago. This is an apartment I've rented intermittently over the years in Malaga. I remember walking around the city in the late afternoon and just seeing a homeless guy with a dog, and they almost seemed to be in conversation, and just the image of it stayed with me, and I started to write this character, and I gave him, typically enough for me, an Irish voice, and he was a kind of a drifter type. And I guess you often write characters, you think, God, what if things had gone otherwise in my own life? If I hadn't managed to write my books and drifted off into a different path, and if things had gone wrong, if I'd had a really bad broken heart, if I wound up homeless in Spain, if I drifted around the provinces for months and weeks and years unending, if my very language started to break down, if my sense of myself as dictated by language started to give way, what would happen then? And I got the story out of that register, out of imagining that voice. Very little happens in the story, but it is one of my favorites in the book because I think once read, it will linger with the reader.
One of the qualities of Extremadura, and I think running through all the stories in this collection, is the sort of inevitable wheel of time, the passage of time. I wonder if that's something that is particularly on your mind.
I guess I've written the stories in this book over the course of my 40s. And I think one of the things that, as you age at that kind of time in your life, is the extent of the past starts to become almost overwhelming. Mm. And you start to view the past in different ways. And one of the things you learn is that the past is unstable. The past is not a fixed entity. The past is shifting and rearranging all the time as you get older, in its meanings, in its language, and in its sense of what you've passed through in your own time. It's fascinating. It's terrifying sometimes. But that sense of the past being not fixed is something that occupies a lot of the characters in this collection, and it certainly occupies their author.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest today, the Irish novelist and short story writer, Kevin Barry. Kevin, let's talk about Saul Bellow's Herzog, which you rather courageously have chosen as one of your favorite books. And I say courageous because it's a canonical text and has been really from the moment it was published in 1964, winning for Bellow a National Book Award, one of three he received in his life, in addition to a Pulitzer Prize. At the center of Herzog is a middle-aged man in the midst of disintegration, mourning the collapse of his marriage, and in a frenzy of letter writing to Adlai Stevenson, to Nehru, to Dr. Martin Luther King, General Eisenhower, Churchill, even letters to himself. I have to say, I hadn't read Herzog, and I'm so grateful to you for bringing my attention to it. Not that I was unaware of it, but I was always slightly daunted by it. What is it about Herzog that speaks to you?
I would say the glorious thing about Herzog is that it's extremely funny. Mm. It's a comedy about a guy having a crack up. There is that very famous opening line, which I have to quote. You can't not quote the opening line of Herzog. "If I am out of my mind," thought Moses Herzog, "it's all right with me." I came at Bellow kind of sideways, kind of crabwise, in my kind of early 20s, like many young writers at that kind of age. I was very taken with the work of Martin Amis, with the kind of late 80s novels, London Fields, The Information, Money. And I started to read Amis's wonderful essays and his nonfiction pieces. And he frequently raved about Saul Bellow, who had only been a name to me. So I don't think the first book I picked up was Herzog. I think it might have been Henderson, The Rain King. But immediately just blown away by the sense of voice just exploding onto the page. And people are sometimes daunted by the prospect of this novel, I think, because they think it's all about sort of intellectual reasoning, where he's going at it with the great philosophers, where he's going into theology, where he's going into all this stuff. He isn't really, you know, it's really about this guy, this kind of failed academic who's gone through a couple of wives already. His most recent wife has just run off with a one-legged radio announcer, a glorious character in his own right in the book. The book is all over the shop. There's very little plot. What amazed me years later, I picked up Herzog at about 95 or 96 when I was 26 or 27. And it passes the test of great books, which is that every time you go back to it in your life, it changes. The book becomes very, very new. I looked into it over the last few days and I was quite horrified to discover that I am now 5 years older than Moses Herzog, who when I first read the book seemed to be older than time. You know, we talked a little bit before about the past changing all the time as you get older and becoming unstable and unfixed. That's certainly the case for Moses as he drifts madly between New York and Chicago and a house in the Berkshires that he bought to do up in the idyllic early moments of this most recent failed marriage. It surprised me when I read years later the biography of Bellow by Zachary Leder, how closely the events of Herzog mirrored the events of Bellow's life. I did read it on Charitable Line about Bellow once. As someone said there were six wives and there was at least two novels out of each of them as he wrote. But so many of the details of Moses' life in the book are very close into Bellow's. But I just love, above everything else, and I still do, the exuberance of the Bellowian sentence that just explodes across the page. There's just beautiful music and a beautiful rhythm to the Bellow sentence as it runs across the page. He's very funny. His characters are really, really funny. He's great at blending high and low. He writes about lowlifes and seedy individuals in a high-blown, brilliantly exploded language. You can see, in retrospect, his influence all over the place in the writers on both sides of the Atlantic who came after him in the kind of 70s and 80s. It's weird, his place in the world of letters since his death. After a great writer dies, there's always that kind of weighing up period over a course of the next couple of decades, you know. I would say it's possibly the case that Bellow's reputation has faded a little. He's very much of his era. But I don't know, I go back there for the sentences. I go back there for his characterization. You don't read Bellow for the plots, but what you get is a world. And a way of expression.
I was going to ask about his reputation, because there does seem to be a kind of reckoning going on with all sorts of writers. Not there's the church bells.
The church bells toll in Malaga behind me. Yes.
The church bells toll for Bellow.
There's definitely a reckoning going on. They do really go for it here on the bell ringing front. It's 6 o'clock, so that's at a special flurry of bells we get at 6 o'clock.
Oh, there we go.
There we go. We're done.
I wonder how acutely you feel that a writer ultimately can't control how posterity is going to view their work.
Yeah, I think it's for every writer, it's something that very usefully put out of one's mind. You know, you're lucky enough if anyone is reading your books when they come out, and it's not something to try and let color or dictate your work in any sense. When I started reading Bellow in the kind of 1990s, I was very against Irish literature. And I was really drawn to those great Jewish American voices, almost in a way that was too narrow and not useful for my own early attempts at fiction. I kind of got it into my mind that I was going to be the next great Jewish American writer as a ginger-haired child in Cork City in Ireland. Didn't work out. And I, shamefacedly now, I'm going to admit that the first attempt I made at a novel in 1998, I decided it was going to be essentially a Jewish American novel, and it was going to be set in Butte, Montana, of all places. So I went there. And my first trip to the US in 1998, I flew to Seattle and I got on a Greyhound bus and I went out to Butte and I landed there about 7 o'clock in the morning. And the first thing that was immediately evident was that there were no Jews in Butte, Montana. And this just wasn't the place for my Jewish American novel, but I tried it anyway. I was not to be deterred. I have the manuscript somewhere at home where I'm essentially trying to write a Jewish American voice. And I'm sure there are kind of nice little bursts of description here or there, but I would be too shamefaced even to look at it myself. It's an interesting thing. I think often when a writer is trying to start out, the difficulty is you get too obsessed with one or two writers. I was certainly absolutely obsessed with like Bellow and Roth and trying to ape them. And it was only when I started to write stories that were set much closer to home that I started to hear the ring of truth more. It's a weird motion early in a writer's life. It's this kind of circular homing in where you're kind of almost avoiding your own fundamental stuff, your own fundamental material, but you're slowly and slowly getting braver and developing a thicker skin and getting more closely into it. There's no way of shortcutting it. You have to slowly, slowly circle around your own material and find it and get in there. But certainly what I took out of my great period of reading Bellow was just an admiration for the great invention of humankind, which is the sentence, and where the sentence can bring us. You know, a novel is made up at the atomic level of the sentence, and it's what you can do with that as a unit of language and poignancy and time, how it can arrest the reader and how it can just simulate life in such a beautiful way. And every sentence Bellow writes at his best, and he's at his best in this period in the kind of early to mid 60s, I would think, when he was in his kind of 40s or going towards 50. I think he was writing his best work around then. Writers are very superstitious about the books that they keep close to their desk, but I would certainly admit that there would be a Bellow novel or two close to my desk. And in those days where you feel sludgy and dry and just like, oh God, do I really have to do this again today? You know, you just pick up a novel like Herzog and open it and just renew yourself on the glory of where the English language sentence can bring the reader.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking to Kevin Barry about Saul Bellow's Herzog. We'll be back for more book talk after this.
Time on the Waggleload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Cat Celebrity, the first of two choices of songs about the moon, starting with songs about different kinds of moon, blue moons and more. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
I'm Janice Adams. Starting Monday, October 6th, join me on my new day at new time, Monday evenings at 8, for the Janice Adams Show. Crucial conversations about race, every race, and courage. The courage to listen, to speak up, to make a way out of no way. The Janice Adams Show, Monday nights at 8, starting October 6th on Radio Catskill.
This is Shelf Life, and I'm talking to Kevin Barry about one of his favourite novels, Saul Bellow's Herzog. Kevin, it's interesting that you say you were distancing yourself from the sort of Irish tradition when you were reading Bellow and other Jewish American writers, because I think Bellow himself would probably say that one of his big influences was James Joyce. Do you see the sort of Joycean influence in Bellow's writing?
I think you can. I think you can see it almost coming, I would say, secondhand out of Faulkner. I think it's the shifting perspective of the Joycean sort of sentence or digression that Faulkner adapted beautifully to an American Southern language. I'd be really interested to look back through the books and see if Bellow ever talked much or wrote much about Faulkner, but I think there's a very definite influence there. It's interesting just to touch on the American South. I've always felt a great affinity myself with writers from the American South, and I think Irish writers feel that generally. We face a lot of similar problems on the page. We come from places where the language is really rich and mellifluous, and it can seem almost overdone on the page if it's not done well. But I've always felt bang at home when I read Flannery O'Connor, or when I read Barry Hannah, or when I read Faulkner.
Barry Hannah is not a name you hear too often anymore. I think he is one of those writers who seems to have been neglected by posterity.
Yeah, I think most people might have come across the name maybe from the David Lynch movie Wild at Heart. Right. I think that was based on a Barry Hannah story. One of the things we get so infrequently, really, when we read literature is a bloody good time, you know, and it was invented to edify and to educate and to instruct us, but it was also invented to give us a good time, to get us through the long winter nights. And there's a great sense of fun in Barry Hannah's stories and in his work. But I would argue that despite the reputation of Bellow, that there are many laughs in Bellow, and that you'll have a good time in these books. It's not going to be all learning.
He's a true lover of vernacular too, isn't he? He seems to be able to summon every tone of the American voice.
Yeah, and especially I guess that Chicago kind of lowlife voice. He's great on Chicago gangsters. He's great on Chicago political classes, the kind of Mayor Daley generation, especially. There's a glorious story about when Bellow won the Nobel Prize. Mayor Daley, the old Mayor Daley, who was still in charge of Chicago at that time, was asked by reporters, "So have you read Herzog, Mayor Daley?" And he said, "I've looked into it," which was beautifully done. But he passed on his congratulations to the native son.
Of course, vernacular is very important and central in your work. Was that in any way influenced by reading Bellow, or is that something you just inherited by being Irish?
No, I think absolutely. I think you realise that if you can get the voices close to home, it's impossible to be too local in your fiction. You know, the more localised, the more parochial your fiction can become, the more chance it has in that perverse way of achieving a universal kind of resonance. And I guess there was something in the way Bellow used his very immediate situation and background and the voices he grew up with on the streets of Chicago and on the streets of Montreal before that, those immigrant voices, and trying to recognize that kind of voice in the Irish idiom and trying to use it as a springboard in my own fiction, I would say certainly. I've always found him inspirational. And you read writers who are clearly great writers and you love them, but they don't necessarily inspire you as such. But I always found Bellow was one of those ones. I'll go back and I'll read a paragraph or two and it'll make me want to pick up a pen. It'll right. make me want to go to the desk and do better, you know. You've got to bring your A game after you've read some Bellowian sentences, you know.
That's very interesting, because I read a quote from Clive James, the writer and critic, who said that Herzog was such a great novel that it made him wonder if it wasn't too late to become an accountant, because he just felt there was nothing left for him to write.
It's a dauntingly high standard. What he does beautifully is he blends so many different notes in his register. It's comic and poignant and kind of dark all at once sometimes, you know. What's impossible to teach, I think, with Pelosi, he's got great comic timing, especially in his dialogue.
There's a lot of soul in Herzog too, and I was left quite moved by the scenes that take place in Canada during his childhood. And at several points in the book, I think Bellow as Herzog recalls pasting labels on bootleg liquor bottles. And you absolutely know that that is real memory in those moments.
Yeah, and I agree that those kind of close in kind of family moments feel like the most felt and memorable moments in the novel. But what you also have is a sense of the larger world and its movements outside of that. And I'd love to quote just a little, a few sentences that I wrote down. I guess this is about the way that time in the century is pressing in on Herzog. In a city, in a century, in transition, in a mass transformed by science under organized power, subject to tremendous controls. In a condition caused by mechanization after the late failure of radical hopes, in a society that was no community and devalued the person owing to the multiplied power of numbers which made itself negligible, which spent military billions against foreign enemies but would not pay for order at home, which permitted savagery and barbarism in its own great cities. So the focus is going from the deeply personal and the familial and the felt and moving out to the larger story, the larger movements that are occupying this time in the American mid-century. Mm. It's this sense of spread, this sense of reach that makes him a truly great novelist, the way he can go close in and then just open it out to what's happening on a broadly universal level to the world around and what's pressing its shapes on these lives.
He seems very concerned too, doesn't he, with how difficult it might be to maintain a kind of sanity or a peace of mind in a very materialistic, noisy society. Is it a challenge for a writer today to avoid distraction?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge for this writer. You have to be rigorous with your attention. Fiction is hard work. Writing fiction is hard work, which requires a deep quality of concentration. And, you know, the quality of concentration is under severe attack in the contemporary moment. I have convinced myself of two things, that there is a God and that she has a lever with which she turns on the internet at 12 noon every day. So it doesn't exist before that. So I leave that time in the morning. I write for kind of 2 or 3 hours in the morning, or at least I'm in the room with the work for 2 or 3 hours in the morning, and I'm not online. It's just that when you go into that noisy online world, your brain is moving like a data processor and it's just going too quickly. Like most writers, I guess, or like a lot of writers, I find first thing in the morning when you're still half asleep can be the most useful time. You know, fiction occurs in the subconscious. It occurs in the back of the brain. The only thing it's similar to in life is dreaming. It comes from the same place. Mm. It comes from that murky subconscious world at the back of the mind. And you're trying to tune into that. And first thing in the morning for me is a good time to do it.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the writer Kevin Barry. Kevin, there's a few scenes late in Herzog that could easily be anecdotes from Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, the second book we're talking about today. Herzog returning to his folly, which is this house in the Berkshires, a Victorian house with something like 40 acres. He finds in the toilet the remains of birds who had nested there before becoming entombed by the falling lid. And I read that and it really put me in mind of the kind of rich detail that clearly delights Annie Dillard and which infuses Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. It's full of stories like that and anecdotes. It was published almost half a century ago and recounts her encounters with nature through the various seasons in the land behind her home in Virginia. I wonder if you can sum up the book's enduring power for you.
Yeah, Annie Dillard, I came across again in the sideways kind of manner where your reading leads you in different directions. So around the late 1990s, I guess I've been reading a lot of people like Jonathan Rabin, the English travel writer now based in Seattle. And I read an essay by Rabin in which he complained about nature writing, especially in North America, about its inherent humorlessness. And he said that the one exception I would make to this is the great Annie Dillard, who is funny, as well as being profoundly gifted in describing the world around herself. It was that throwaway remark in an essay that sent me to hunt out books by Annie Dillard. And the first one I found, I guess it's their most famous title, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. So it's taken directly from her diaries over the course of a year, early 1970s, I guess about 1973 or 74. So she's a very young woman writing this book. She's in her 20s, which is terrifying when you read the book and the sheer quality of the gleaming intelligence that comes from every page and her beautiful, sparky prose style. I went to Google Maps today just before joining you, and you can all go there now and have a look at Thinker Creek in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. Very simple structure to the book, the changing seasons of the year. She describes it in a very close-in, atomic way. What's going on with the muskrats? What's going on in the stream? What's going on around? She's a spiritual writer, not a religious writer. She's sometimes characterized as writing in a religious way, which I don't agree with. I would really love to quote the opening paragraph of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek if I could.
Kevin, you have the floor.
I used to have a cat, an old fighting Tom, who would jump through the open window by my bed in the middle of the night and land on my chest. I'd half awaken. He'd stick his skull under my nose and purr, stinking of urine and blood. Some nights he kneaded my bare chest with his front paws, powerfully arching his back as if sharpening his claws or pummeling a mother for milk. And some mornings I'd wake in daylight to find my body covered with paw prints and blood. I looked as though I'd been painted with roses. And it's the closer, the clinching phrase from that paragraph. I looked as though I'd been painted with roses. Okay. It's just a mark of greatness. That is the mark of Annie Dillard's genius, I think. I've read a great deal of her work now, and she is so dense sometimes in the laser focus she puts on her subjects and the quality of attention and intelligence she brings to it. Sometimes you don't know what's going on. There's a book called Holy the Firm, and I've read and admired and loved it, and I haven't a clue what's going on for at least half of it. Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is probably a more gentle introduction to the Dillard style and the Dillard view of the world. Weirdly, it turns out to be a great pandemic book. We've all been spending so much time close to home that the radius of our movement has closed in so much in this recent kind of era, this kind of epoch changing time. And we've had to look very closely. We've all gone on those walks, those kind of ritual walks, so very close to home. What you find is the quality of your attention does improve, and you start to notice the smallest, most minute changes in the year and by the month and by the season. And Pilgrim at Tinker Creek does this. I guess you can't talk about this book without talking about Thoreau in some ways, but it's this sense of coming away from the noise and maelstrom of life, finding this rock to sit on in a stream and to just listen and to watch and to try and enter the moment of your life. And it's something that she manages to do in every page of this book, I think.
You mentioned Thoreau, and I found this book to be a fantastic debunking, really, of that kind of American mythology of the single man out in the wilderness, the kind of Thoreau, John Muir. I mean, wonderful, vivid writing, but still the sense that you somehow need to go on a real journey to discover something. With Annie Dillard, what is so refreshing is this. She's a miniaturist. You can find everything within a few miles of your home. She does this wonderful thing of really making one appreciate the sort of richness that exists in a single square foot of your backyard or garden. The way she's able to observe everything from the sort of mating habits of the praying mantis to the starlings and the way they fly through the trees. And it's almost like she is creating the sense that nature is a kind of magician. It's all these sleights of hand and tricks, and they happen in full view. I found that very refreshing because it invites you to experience it yourself without having to do a tremendous amount, actually.
It does, and it's almost a great charter for idlers, this book. There's no such thing as a wasted, mopey walk around a field. What I think makes this book timeless is the sense of all life is contained within every kind of blade of grass. She's almost in that very old-fashioned sense a pantheist You know, it's pantheistic. It's God in nature. It's a book that I've gone back to very frequently over the years and very rarely read from start to finish, but it's one of those books that you pick up and you open any page and you fall into some sort of observation about a muskrat or whatever it is. And you're just in trance for the few pages you stay with it. Many of us have been thinking about Joan Didion a lot since her sad passing. And it's interesting, in the early 1970s, you have these two young essayists and absolute polar opposites in terms of the approach to the world and how to describe it. And both with an equal resonance, you know, one with the widescreen view on societal movement and what's going on in the world at large as it changes. And Annie sat on her rock in the middle of a stream in the Blue Ridge Mountains and bringing back these reports to us of equal import to anything else that was been written in the nonfiction mode at that time. It's hard to talk about Annie Dillard's work without just picking up the book and endlessly quoting from it. I always consider a book a mode of transport. That's what great literature does. It lifts us up from where we are and sets us down elsewhere. And this book sets us down in the middle of that stream on the rock with Annie in the changing seasons of 1974.
You talked about her capacity for wit. There's a moment where she says, which made me think of your writing, there are 7 or 8 categories of phenomena in the world that are worth talking about. And one of them is the weather. I just thought that must appeal to the Irishman in you.
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs of Limerick City, but the city was still very much growing at that time. And so literally at the end of my street, the countryside began. So I was living in, I guess, terrain vague, in that lovely French term, that kind of vague kind of landscape. And as a kid, been drawn into the woods and been drawn to streams, and always at difficult times in my life. And I guess it's a universal thing to seek solace in nature in some way, whether that's going to sit on a bench in a park and look at a tree, or whether it's going much more farther afield. And I certainly remember around the time I was reading Annie Dillard first in my kind of late 20s, very difficult time in so many people's lives. The flush of youth has flown and you're trying to figure out exactly who you are and exactly what you're going to do. And I decided at this time I was going to write novels and books of stories and plays. And this didn't seem at all like an easy or likely thing to achieve. So I bought a little caravan. It was about 12 foot long. And I put it in a field in West Cork on the southwest coast of Ireland. And I sat in it for 4 months and tried to write a novel, and it was terrible. But I got the sense that what needed to happen was a kind of a transaction. To make something that was worth reading by anybody, you had to kind of make a pact with your own subconscious. You had to say, here I am and I'm available for material. Give me stuff. Give me stories. And I would have to say I had a very Dillardian moment late that summer when I went walking one day on a cliff top, and I just sat there, keeping out of the wind up on a cliff, looking out at the Atlantic. As I sat there, I felt this fluttering nearby. And I looked up and there was a hare standing up on its hind legs. It had crawled out of a set, out of its burrow in the cliff face. And for whatever reason, it didn't catch a whiff of me. And it was maybe 6 or 7 feet from me. And it lasted this moment, maybe 15 seconds, 20 seconds, where I just looked at this hare in its majesty as it just looked up, looked out across the cliff. And it lasted 15 seconds, but it seemed to go on forever and forever and forever. And it took off, and I took it as an augury that I was on the right path in my life, and that I was doing the right thing, and that I needed to give up all the freelance journalism commitments that I had, that I needed to tune into the stuff that wasn't the everyday, that was away from the mainstream, that I needed to commit to my writing, that there was magic to be found in writing. So Annie Dillard has a lot to be blamed for. And send me into this very impressionable place in my life at that time. But it was around that time I made that pact with myself. I remember on one of those walks that summer, one day, I'm sure my lips were moving as I talked to myself. And I remember saying to myself, are you serious? Are you actually going to do this? Are you going to write in a real way? Because I could sense from my early terrible failed efforts that, you know, there was such a mountain to be scaled. And I said, yeah, I'm going to do it. You know, I don't care. I'm going to give it everything I can and everything it needs. And I think of that day as my writer's birthday.
Mm.
It was the 13th of August in 1999, and I kind of mark it still, you know. And it's from falling into books like Pinker at Pilgrim Creek and books by Jonathan Rabin about paying attention to what's around you, about paying close attention to what's going on with the weather, about paying close attention to what's going on with the birds, about valuing those lives and those sensations as much as anything in the human sphere. These are necessary things to achieve, I think, sometimes if you're going to settle to your own true vocations and paths in life.
So 13th of August 1999 is this day when you commit to this sort of self-actualization as a writer. But it must have been much harder than that to get from that moment with the hare, or you locking eyes with the hare, and feeling that you could relax, that you had succeeded as a writer.
Yeah. Over the course of the following winter, sort of winter 99-2000, I started to write some short stories that for the first time I felt, oh, actually, this isn't bad. I have that very old-fashioned Damon Runyon background as a writer on small city newspapers. So I was never in the kind of creative writing sphere. There wasn't very much of it at that time in Ireland. So I was never in workshops or anything like that. I never showed my early attempts at fiction to anybody. But what I did find around this period was it became very important to declare it, to tell people, I'm doing this. You almost have to like come out about it. You know, you have to say, listen, I'm writing a novel, you know.
And it seems that location is super pertinent and inextricable. And I'm thinking of, you know, heading to Butte, Montana to be inspired for your Jewish American novel, and your time in Spain, of course. Has it always been that way, that place precedes story for you?
Everything I write starts with a place. Every story, all of the novels to date, it's always been a place, has been the initial kind of germination point, or the initial spark. Just that sense of here's something I can work with. And I can look at everything I've written and originated to a place. So one of the things it means is it can be very important for a writer to get out into the world a little bit, and move about. Something I've missed in the pandemic, not been able to travel, and missing that sense of inspiration. But again, I guess turning back to Annie Dillard, trying to find it closer to home, within our smaller constrained radius of these recent years.
Yeah, I guess the lesson of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is that the place can be in your own backyard. It doesn't have to be very far.
It doesn't have to be far. It doesn't have to be dramatic in its effects. It doesn't have to be spectacular. It just needs to make its demand on you. It needs to make its demand on your subconscious. It needs to be allowed to filter into your dreams, and it needs to be allowed to turn you in the directions it's going to turn you.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real treat.
I really enjoyed it, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking about Herzog by Saul Bellow, published by Penguin, and Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard, published by HarperCollins. Kevin Barry's latest story collection, That Old Country Music, is also published by Penguin. My thanks, as always, to our producer, Ilya Maritz, and to our sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. You can find this episode and plenty more like it on all good podcast platforms.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Homestead School, Montessori education, preschool through early college with campuses in Glens Bay and Hurleyville, building the intelligence, creativity, connection, and skills for an ecological future since 1978. TheHomesteadSchool.com. And from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, cookbook author and television host Samin Nosrat, star of the Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. He'll talk to Hrishikesh Hirway about her new book, Good Things: Recipes and Rituals to Share with People You Love. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.